I mean, the point about all these things, you know, whether you're talking about a liberal world order or whether you want to call it a rule of law-based international system, I mean, whatever language you want to choose, none of them exists if people aren't willing to enforce it. And we've gotten very used to the idea that enforcing it doesn't mean much. It just means people meet in a room a few times a year and, you know, have conversations. But it's clear now that with these very direct, violent challenges, that some of that defense may mean real military defense.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Hello and welcome to Liberal Half Hour, Liberal Halvtime. My name is Erik Løkke and I will be your host. For the benefit of our foreign guest, this episode will be in English. I have the pleasure of welcoming back Anne Applebaum. Anne really does not need any further introduction, as she is one of the great intellectuals of our time. Anne's writing is sometimes thought-provoking, always enlightening, and very influential. She is a staff writer at Atlantic and senior fellow at John Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. In addition, she has written numerous books about authoritarianism and democracy. She is in Oslo as a part of the Oslo Freedom Forum, and Civita, as a partner to the Oslo Freedom Forum, got the chance to invite her to a talk. We had a conversation based on her piece in The Atlantic titled "There is no liberal world order. Unless democracies defend themselves, the forces of autocracy will destroy them." We discuss why a liberal world order is a good thing, and what is the future of this order, if any, and how can democracies defend and enforce a liberal order? These are some of the questions I discuss with Anne Applebaum. I am also joined by Ulf Sverdrup, Director of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, NUPI. This conversation was originally streamed as Digital Lunch, but now we also publish it as a podcast. So stay tuned for the next 30 minutes for my conversation with Ulf Sverdrup and Anne Applebaum. Anne, you wrote an excellent piece in The Atlantic some weeks ago, and I'm sure we're going to get into several of these points you make there. But just to start, when we talk about a liberal world order, how would you define that term? What are we talking about?
I think we're talking about a set of norms and assumptions about how nation states behave with one another, that they respect borders, that they abide by some forms of international law, that there are some rules that govern trade, that govern the law of the sea, that govern transportation, that we are able to meet, I don't know, at the United Nations or at other bodies, regulatory bodies, where we can jointly decide how to do things like make sure airplanes land, whether they're landing in Pyongyang or Oslo or San Francisco, but also whether there's a law of the sea, whether there are essentially whether there are rules that govern relationships between states. But all of that is dependent on the belief that there could and should be such rules. And those rules are connected to a liberal idea of international relations. In other words, that it is possible to have negotiations between states, that you can come up with treaties that everybody will abide by.
Obviously, this term has been contested and there are different understandings of it. And some even say that we never had a liberal world order. To what extent do you think that we actually have experienced a liberal world order the last 30, 40 years?
I mean, we've certainly experienced something since 1945 that is distinct from the previous period, especially in Europe, which is where it worked the best. And so you can make up a different word for it if you don't like the word liberal, because that has other implications, or if you want to call it something else, that's fine. But there was a, but particularly in Europe, where thanks to the European Union and the OSCE and NATO and a host of other organizations, relations between states were very highly regulated, in fact. And but also even beyond that, the process of globalization included a lot of other states into this too. And here, I'm not talking about globalization in economic terms. That's a separate subject. I'm talking about, again, the law of the sea, respect for borders, the use of international institutions to resolve conflicts. Didn't work everywhere, but it worked very well in Europe, and it worked well enough in many other places.
Mm. Ulf, how important is it with a global order called the liberal global order, both for the world as such and especially for Norway?
Well, I think it's important for all countries and all peoples to have order instead of chaos. A liberal order is also to prefer to an illiberal order, I think. So, to your question, I think for small states in general, they are more vulnerable. They have much more to lose from a world that is more chaotic because small states, they don't have the powers and they don't have the capacity. So they are as the biggest states. So they have to rely a bit more on rules and expect not only themselves, but also others to abide by those rules. Okay. So for Norway, for instance, the order has been a massive gift to our country. So on the one hand, our sovereignty and security is secured by this. But as Anne alluded to, the UNCLOS, the UN Convention on Law of the Seas, has actually regulated our access to natural resources. So the oil and gas resources that we benefit so much from is basically based on the principle that the global community accepts that those resources are within our territorial waters and that we can exploit those resources. Mm. And likewise, so this has been important for the last 30 years. Now, looking into the future, the Norwegian country is changing from being a petrostate to a global investor state. And it means that we have $1 trillion invested abroad. And then again, the security of those investments abroad also depend on international legal order with some kind of rules to make sure that the fortune of future generations can benefit and has safe investments in other countries, etc. So this is something that shapes the whole country. This is only for Norway, but this could apply for almost all countries, I think. Mm.
And how has Russia's attack changed the liberal world order, if it has changed?
So, I mean, I think there have been, that system that you're describing has been deteriorating for some time. I don't think this is the first piece of evidence. One of the phenomenon that has been gaining in strength or gaining in, there's been more of it, is something called transnational repression. And this is the act of dictators in one country reaching across the border, to whether it's to kill their dissidents or their citizens who are living in other countries, whether it's to kidnap them, whether it was in the case of the Belarusian dictator to order an airplane out of the sky in order to arrest somebody who's on it because they're flying over the airspace. I mean, these are kind of violations of that system that you're describing, and they're small ones. What Putin has done in attacking Ukraine, I mean, really, this dates from 2014. But what he's done in attacking Ukraine is say, I don't respect the rules of that, that there's anything sacrosanct about borders. I don't respect the fact that there's a sovereign state, in that country, and I'm going to destroy it. He's saying, by kidnapping and murdering and putting Ukrainians in concentration camps and then deporting them, he's saying that a whole host of rules about the Geneva Convention and, the UN Declaration on Human Rights and the UN Conventions on Genocide, I don't believe in any of that and I don't care about any of it anymore. And so what he's done is actually not just an attack on Ukraine, it's an attack on that set of rules. And it's particularly important in Europe because it's a way of saying that things that you thought you learned after the Second World War, you thought we had learned not to behave this way and you had this mantra, never again. And look, I'm going to show you that I don't care about any of it. And that's part of what he's doing. I mean, that's the That's the ideological piece of the war. Mm. And so I think this is a deliberate and open attack on all of those things, in addition to being an attempt to not just, I think it's not, it's partly an attempt to grab territory in Ukraine, but it's also an attempt to undermine and destroy Ukraine as a sovereign state.
Mm. Ulf, it's tempting, and not to do too much, what about this? But there are those people who say that also the West has been engaged in undermining the world order, the U.S. attack on Iraq, and I mean, you have probably other examples as well. Is this relevant in this discussion, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, yes or no. I think that one of the most important changes is that this liberal order that Anne talks about really came about after the Second World War. But it changed quite radically after 1989. It became more of a global order. It used to be a more of a Western order, Europe, some other countries, but also, and of course, US and Canada. But then it became more global. And that created some, and it became more liberalism, perhaps also, rather than institutionalism. And I think that undermined a bit or changed the order. So it became kind of less of a security community and also less of a political community. So this is a part of what some would describe, like Eikenberry and others, like a bit of a crisis for the liberal international order. And then, of course, there's this idea that you have to hold yourself accountable to the norms and procedures that you advocate. I think that's an important argument that, and maybe the West has, or some in the West have not always acted upon that in a truthful and honest way. But I think that we have managed to uphold these values pretty well, I think. Mm.
And what's your comment or opinion to those people who say, well, the Russia is just doing what the US did in 2003, what we did in Kosovo, and so on and so forth? Is it any comparison?
I don't draw a direct comparison. I mean, I do think for a longer conversation, I do think there are ways in which the West has undermined the so-called liberal world order as well. I mean, Iraq is very complicated because the United States was entered into Iraq not in order to change the borders or to make Iraq into a colony, but in order to remove weapons of mass destruction from Iraq, which they did believe, I'm sorry to say, were there. And they believed it partly because Saddam Hussein wanted them to believe it or wanted his generals to believe it. And so that was why that was why they heard that intelligence. And so they understood that what they were doing was preventing a greater crisis or tragedy. And you can make the same argument about Afghanistan. That was a response to a terrorist attack, an attempt to... So neither of those are quite the same as what Russia's doing. They were not wars of territorial conquest. Most of the other wars, I mean, there's some exceptions that we've had in the world in the last couple of decades, have been civil wars. Some really bitter and awful. I mean, Afghanistan, I suppose, is one of those too. But they haven't been direct challenges to, as I said, to rules about borders, to rules about human rights, in quite the way that the Russian assault on Ukraine is. And I think one of the reasons why Ukraine has created so much energy and why people all over the world are so interested in it or supportive of the Ukraine and its president is because they understand that intuitively, that there's something different about this conflict. But, having said that, I mean, U.S. behavior in Afghanistan and Iraq left often much to be desired. And there's certainly the length of time that we were in both countries contributed a lot to the deterioration of, an idea that there was something fair about international relations. Yes, I do think so.
Can I just add to that? I think that So if you look at Putin's arguments returning to Ukraine, I think one argument that he is putting forward is that this order has come to an end, is collapsing, not because it's kind of overreach from the Western countries or something like that, but that the Western countries themselves are leaving the order. Right.
Well, his argument is that they're very weak.
Yeah, they're
they
very
don't
weak.
They don't care about it anymore.
Yeah, then, yeah and so his, we don't care about this.
So, we don't. It's all fake, and so he can intervene. Right. And right,
right, and I think so. So that's why probably he thought also that the response to the invasion yes. would not be so coordinated and so strong, etc. So I think so this is. As of course, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Kosovo, and others are important. It's also important the kind of the rhetoric that's been going on in the U.S. about what kind of role the U.S. would like to have in the future world order, liberal order. Mm-hmm. After all, the U.S. has been very important in partly designing, but also upholding this order. Mm-hmm. What kind of role would it like to have in Europe? UK decided to pull out of the EU. So there have been these signs that also there's some key countries in the Western liberal order have been kind of pulling back from that order. Mm. I think that is very important.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And Putin saw that and understood that as a sign of weakness. I think you're right. I think both the experience of the Trump presidency and of Brexit convinced him that we don't care about any of this anymore. Mm. Yes.
And there is an interesting, lack of a better word, and a discussion about how to understand the Ukraine or the Ukraine narrative. Is this a universal fight for democracy, Ukraine, democratic Ukraine against authoritarian Russia? Or is this a distinct geopolitical conflict between Ukraine and Russia and has really nothing to do with this universal battle between democratic states and authoritarian states? What is your
opinion? I think it's both. I mean, obviously there's a particular local aspects to it, but I mean, I think very much that this is a state making the argument that it's allowed to choose its own political system and it wants to be a democracy and it wants to be integrated with the rest of the world. And it's come up against a larger, more brutal state that won't allow that. And everybody can see that that has implications in other parts of the world. I mean, you can see it in China and Taiwan is the most obvious, but surely there will be others. So I think the reason why there's been so much interest in and attention paid to this story is because the universal implications of this particular regional story are so clear.
Mm. What's your view? Should we view Ukraine, Russia as a particular or distinct geographic war, or is there a universal aspect here?
No, I think it's actually dangerous. If you only look at the situation going on in Ukraine as a pure Russia-Ukraine situation, I see it's different circles. So of course, obviously there's a Russian-Ukraine element to this, but there's also a Europe-Russia relationship. So the relationship between the US, NATO, and Europe, etc. And then you have the larger kind of strategic stability issue between the US and Russia on nuclear weapons and all those things. And then even further, you see the whole discussion about the future global order. And I think that the signing of this statement between President Putin and President Xi Jinping at the opening of the Olympics, or more or less at that time, signify some kind of, hey, and that they are looking to create a new world order. And that triggered, I think, a bit of the response. So I don't think it would have been possible to have a so global response to the invasion of Ukraine or attack on Ukraine without having this much bigger picture.
This is true. The Russians themselves have said this. I mean, Putin has said it. Lavrov has said it.
Yeah.
They've said this is, you know, this is about recreating the world order, about redoing geopolitics. And the Chinese have seemed to agree with them.
Yeah, and the Chinese also advocate they want a new model of major power relations. So they use these phrases of where they would like to have a redesign of the international order in some sense. Although China might have a slightly different view on what would be the future order than compared to Russia.
And one of your central points in the Atlantic in your piece is that democracies have to defend themselves in order to promote a liberal world order. If you were to summarize how democracies should defend themselves, what would you outline?
So, I mean, the point about all these things, you know, whether you're talking about a liberal world order or whether you want to call it a rule of law-based international system, I mean, whatever language you want to choose, none of them exists if people aren't willing to enforce it. And we've gotten very used to the idea that enforcing it doesn't mean much. It just means people meet in a room a few times a year and, you know, have conversations. But it's clear now that with these very direct, violent challenges, that some of that defense may mean real military defense. Zelensky is the first to experience that attack. In fact, the first was in 2014. And you could also go back to the wars in Yugoslavia and talk about that. That's a, you know, maybe another earlier example of this, but we felt that we somehow controlled that. But starting in 2014, Ukraine is under attack, and had Ukraine not been able to defend itself, Ukraine would now be part of Russia. And if Poland and the Baltic states and maybe even the eastern half of Germany were not able to defend themselves and were not part of NATO, they might also now be part of Russia. So if you care about maintaining that kind, your own political system and your own sovereignty, you may have to be willing to defend it. Mm. And I think, I mean, of course, that's always been true. It's just that we've been so lucky in the last several decades that we haven't had to take any of those choices seriously.
Ulf, has there been a sort of decadence within the European Union and Europe have been too convinced that a liberal world order comes by itself, that it's not necessary to defend it or spend enough money on in example, military spending?
Obviously, we have outsourced, in Europe, we have outsourced much of our security to the Americans. So they have paid and we have spent the money on welfare, right? So that's been a trade-off. Now I think Europeans are getting ready to invest more in defense and maybe spend a little less on welfare. So changing the balance.
The question is if that goes home with voters, though.
No, but I think that so democracy has lots of flaws. Mm. Compared to other forms of governance, it's probably the least painful way of governing, right? So, but I think that we are now at a point in time where we have a wave moving towards authoritarian rule, strongman rule. So what we have achieved for 30 years are somehow reversing. So, and the most popular form of governance in the world now is not pure autocracy, but what we could call some kind of elected autocracy. So you get elected by some kind of election, but you're not so concerned about being re-elected. You continue governing and gradually undermine the democratic institutions. We had to make sure that this is not happening in our own continent, in Europe. And we have to stand up for our principles. And then if we can do that by an example, I think that that's the best way of sending that message to others as well. Mm. We should be cautious about our ability to export our form of governance without taking care of our own democracy.
Mm. How do you think that the war in Ukraine will affect democracies in the world? Or let me rephrase, how important is it that Ukraine win for democracy in the future?
Oh, I think, I mean, you know, if you think of the world after a Ukrainian victory, meaning that the Russians are expelled from Ukraine and Ukraine is given some kind of security guarantees to ensure that it remains a viable state, that's what I would consider victory to be, then it has an enormous effect on politics in Europe. It has an inspirational effect on other parts of the world. It encourages people to believe in the possibility of democracy, even in smaller, weaker states in difficult places. And then conversely, if you imagine the world, what it looks like if Ukraine loses and Russia occupies Kiev and the country is overrun and destroyed and turned into a huge concentration camp, well, then you can imagine how dictators are inspired by that on every continent.
Mm. Ulf, how important is it that Ukraine win here? Or, yeah.
I think Anne put it very clearly. Mm. That this is a battle or a war struggle that will have huge consequences, not only for the Ukrainians, of course, but in all regions in the world. So it's a fight for principles that we are into.
Does that mean that the West and Norway should step up its support to Ukraine?
I think Norway have done quite a bit, but we have to prepare for this being a long struggle. And it will be very expensive, not only in humanitarian sacrifice or military contribution, but also in economic and social spending and financial stability for Ukraine. So I think last week the EU aired some ideas about the long-term structure, kind of financial restructuring and support plan for Ukraine. And we have to be clear on this as well. It will be expensive. Lots of people will have to contribute to that. Mm.
Do you think that the West is doing enough? And I mean, the US has $40 billion in support to Ukraine. That's impressive.
Yeah, no, there is actually no precedent for what the US is doing. I mean, maybe you could look at how the US helped the UK at the beginning of the Second World War. We had something called the Lend-Lease Program. Mm. But you can't find any example of us helping another country like in this way at that level. In the intervening, decades. So yes, it's unprecedented. I mean, there is still a question about whether it's enough, because it has to be not just enough to, protect, a large part of Ukraine. I think it has to be enough to push the Russians out. And that may need a different level of weapons in the, quite soon in the next month or two. Mm. And it may be even possible with the right weapons in the next month or two to end the war more quickly, which would be the best way that it could end.
Are you convinced that the US support will continue if you have a Republican majority or a Trump coming back in 2024?
No, I'm not convinced. I mean, it's hard to, I don't want to be too negative, and a lot depends. Actually, a lot of the elected Republicans, so Republicans in Congress, have been very in favor of the war. Mitch McConnell, who's the leader of the Senate, was just in Kiev. Many Republicans have spoken very eloquently in favor. So it's not a dividing line between the two parties. I mean, there is a part of the Republican Party that's against the war, partly because they're either attracted to or funded by Putin, or because they're using the war as an opportunity to say, Biden's not spending enough on Americans, something like that. Mm. So that is certainly a danger over time. Mm. It's not a danger right now, but yes, I would think if we're still talking about a war going on a year from now, then yes, it's a problem.
Mm. Ulf, how dangerous is it for Ukraine and Zelensky that Europeans get tired of the war and just want to focus on something else?
I think it's partly, of course, Ukraine is fully dependent on support from the West. But it's on, not only military financially, but also the attention and interest and engagement in the war. So this is important. Of course, the Ukrainians will fight even without the support. So they are very heroic, but it will be very different. Mm. I think that the West should also pay attention to some of the negative consequences of the war for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So in the long-term support for Western liberal order, if we assume that this is also a struggle for that order, we have to compensate for, so see how we can find some way of compensating for the negative effects experienced by the others. Mm. It could be about food security, it could be about suffering in other parts of the world. So we have to keep that in mind as well. Mm.
Obviously, there's a lot of things we could discuss and we can discuss later on, but we're moving towards the end here. And I want to raise a final point, and that was an interesting critique from Francis Fukuyama in Wall Street Journal. I'm sure you read it, where he discussed the meaning of liberal values or ideology. To what extent does liberalism as an idea or liberal values as an idea mean something in terms of shaping world politics?
I think it does mean something. I mean, one of the interesting things about this moment is that at least in the United States and in many European countries, over the last couple of decades, we've had this almost culture war between people who say they believe in liberal values on the one hand, and that includes ranging from respect for the rule of law to certain kinds of tolerance to a certain idea of society, on the one hand, and then people who believe in some kind of nationalism or patriotism on the other. And one of the things the Ukraine war does is it shows you can have a kind of national patriotic defense of a liberal society. And I think that's been a really important lesson for everybody, that liberalism doesn't mean weakness. It also can be strength. And there's even a way in which, because Ukraine is a democracy and because it has, for example, elected leaders and elected local leaders as well as the president, it's able to fight better. And the corruption of Russia and the hierarchy of Russia and the nihilism of Russia have meant the Russians fight worse. We're seeing an example in real life of how being a liberal nation that cares about its sovereignty and its political system can give you a kind of even military strength.
Mm. In your view, how important is ideology or liberal values as such in shaping world politics?
I think it's extremely important, one thing that I puzzle with is that if the world is growing more authoritarian, will these countries also be engaged in international cooperation one way or the other, or will there be a very different style of... So I think there's a link between liberal democracies and a liberal international order. I think it would be very difficult to have some kind of... It would be a very different order if it's composed by authoritarian countries. So in that sense, there's a very close link, I think, between what is happening in countries, in domestic scene, and what is happening at the international scene.
Mm. I think we can come back, and obviously there's a lot of things we can discuss further, among other, the rise of China, which we hasn't mentioned this particular time, but obviously plays an enormous role for the future liberal order. But I just want to end by thanking Anne Applebaum and Ulf Sverdrup for sharing your thoughts on Civita here. Thank you. And thank you for watching.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to listen to more from Anne Applebaum, I recommend my podcast with her 1 year ago, when we discussed her book, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. You will find it at our archive for Liberal Halvtime. Let me also recommend Oslo Freedom Forum. Check out oslofreedomforum.com for many powerful stories and inspirational stories about activists fighting for democracy and human rights across the world. Highly recommendable. Before we end, if you support our work, and I hope you do, please rate our show on iTunes and feel free to leave a review. This will increase our audience outreach. If you have questions or comments or critique, please feel free to send me an email. My email is, as always, eric@civita.no. Thanks for listening. Hope you will stay tuned for further episodes.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.